Thank you. You can hear me. I guess it's up to me to start bringing us home and finishing up the conference. I'd like to start off by pointing out many of my enablers and co-conspirators, many of which are in this room here. And also to thank the organizers for putting on a fantastic workshop. I've learned quite a bit here. So what are we all here really to do? What we want to do is connect something that looks like this, which is our supernova remnant of the day, Cass A, back to its progenitor, or its supernova if you don't really care too much about the progenitor's evolution. So the basic theme of my talk is connecting a supernova remnant back to some sort of progenitor. It doesn't matter if it's a 1A or a core collapse. Carlos put this very succinctly yesterday, though. He said you cannot study the spectra of supernova remnants without considering the dynamical evolution. And you cannot, but it doesn't go both ways. It's not a two-way street. If you study just the dynamics, that tells you nothing about what the spectra is doing, because that it's like the streets in Boston. They're one way. Okay. So what we have here is 50 years of Cass A, 60 years of Cass A, and there's a lot of information encoded in something like this. We're basically looking at a remnant when it was practically not there. I mean, in 1951, it consisted of this filament right here, Minkowski's filament, and then some nebulosity. But over the last 60 years or so, it's just exploded into this almost fully formed shell. And as Danny Milosavich showed earlier today, you can basically go through here and mow the lawn with a spectrometer and get all the information, including the velocity and the spectral abundances, basically, in the velocity of the ejecta and the swept-up circumstellar environment. This is important information because you need this to then pass on to the modelers, and they can then turn their cranks and tell you what type of star exploded and how it exploded. But as I said earlier, you know, the dynamics or the spectra that we observe, especially when we observe this in X-rays, is inherently linked to the dynamics. And I think that this is captured quite succinctly in a paper by Martin Lamming and Una Wang, or Wang and Lamming, 2009, where spectroscopically they require a small cavity to occur around the progenitor of Cass A prior to explosion. That's the only way that they can reproduce the observed electron temperatures and ionization ages. Now, this is interesting because the spectra require this, and as I'm going to show later, the spectra require this in other remnants as well. But if you just look at the dynamics, well, it's not so cut and dry. This is some simulations by Van Vielen and collaborators in 2009, and they just were measuring the hydrodynamics alone. In particular, they're measuring the dynamics of the forward shock and the reverse shock, and they found that either no or a very, very short Wolf-Rayet phase. I think they actually write in the ANA abstract that they do not require a Wolf-Rayet phase in order to explain the dynamics. So this is contrary to what the spectra are showing us. Now, you can go in the other direction, and you can look at these nice, extremely detailed simulations done by Salvatore Orlando and others, where they've done this for 87A, and more recently they've done it. This looks an awful lot. This, not the thing in the background, that's clearly the remnant. But this distribution of iron and this other stuff that they're showing clearly looks like the supernova remnant that we observe today. But there's a problem here. At least I see it as a problem, and maybe it's not a problem. Their model predicts that there still needs to be about a tenth of a solar mass of unshocked iron, which is considerably more than is expected from the rather complete census that was done by Una and Martin in 2012. Now, Danny said there can be some iron left in Cass A. It's got to be there, and maybe that can explain the discrepancy that we observe between the titanium and the iron. But he said that there's not a solar mass of iron, and I would argue that there's probably not a tenth of a solar mass of iron either. There's not that much ejecta left in Cass A. So, okay. But there are other remnants as well. Just to show this pretty movie one last time, because it is, you know, it really does, you can just look at it and stare at it and say, wow, there's no other remnant in our galaxy where we can do something like this. I'm sorry, I keep stepping away from the microphone. But the thing is in reality, most of the remnants that we observe are nothing like this. We don't have the fidelity that we get with Cass A. And this is all I'm going to say about this remnant, because we've kind of been beaten over the head with it today. All right. We can do we can play these sorts of games with other remnants where we look at their spectra and we say, oh, this spectra shows an excess of nitrogen and oxygen, for instance, which is what Dan Castro found when looking at G296. And he argued that this excess of neon and oxygen is very indicative or possibly indicative of a Wolf-Rayet progenitor. And more recently, and quite exciting, I might add, is that this new result on RxJ1713, where they find ejecta, but in that paper, they actually argue that the high shock speed relative to its age, this is directly from the paper, suggests that this supernova remnant result is from a supernova 1BC. Without any modeling or ever, they come to that conclusion. And I want to stress that you really do need to try to connect these spectra up with the dynamics in order to make statements like this. So what I'm going to do now is show an example of where we can do these joint hydrodynamic spectral simulations, and we can come to conclusions about what the progenitor was or what the explosion type was, and then we're going to try to flip the question around and say, do the progenitor models that we have give us the types of supernova remnants that we observe? So this is Kepler's supernova remnant. We haven't talked much about Kepler in this conference, which is unfortunate because it's a beautiful supernova remnant. It's got this bow shock structure to the north, which suggests that there was a pre-supernova outflow, which was sweeping up a large amount of interstellar material. Chiatelis and collaborators perform these highly detailed simulations in order to reproduce this morphology. And what they found was that in order to get the observed structure, which basically means that there's a stagnation point up in the bow shock right about here, of around 2 to 4 parsecs, they required, given the standard CSM parameters of the ambient density and some sort of systemic velocity of the progenitor, they require a mass loss rate of 10 to the minus 5 to 10 to the minus 6 solar masses per year. Now, there's some uncertainty in this stagnation point, which I'll come back to. But what Carlos and myself and Sang Wook and Martin Laming decided to do was take this one step further and say, okay, let's start with this model right here, and let's see what happens if we explode a type 1a supernova into this circumstellar environment. Do we get what we observed with Kepler? Well, we certainly don't want to try to reproduce the whole morphology. And at this point, I do want to point out that Steve Reynolds and his student did do something like this, and they produced these beautiful simulations where they were able to reproduce the CSM and then make some statements about the supernova remnant. It's quite nice, so I apologize for not including that here. All right, so what we're looking at here now is the X-ray spectrum of Kepler's supernova remnant. The CSM parameters that give you this complicated structure in the north will necessarily be the same ones that give you a sort of isotropic outflow in the south. You can look at the ejecta, ejecta spectrum. You see the characteristic lines that we're all familiar with, especially in type 1As. You get a bright iron line, you get calcium, argon, silicon, and sulfur. We measure the bulk properties of this remnant, which are the line fluxes, basically the silicon lines and the sulfur line centroids, the silicon line centroids, and also the iron line centroid is quite well measured. Okay. So then what we do is we take a model for a type 1A supernova. This is a 1.4 solar mass carbon oxygen white dwarf, and we evolve it into an isotropic wind with the parameters that were determined by the CSM interaction. The two models that we choose are a sort of a bright 1A, which gives us around a solar mass of nickel 56 or a solar mass of iron, and then a dim 1A. I guess Carlos prefers the terminology dim versus subluminous. That's what he was saying yesterday anyway. So you get significantly less nickel 56, so the iron content in the ejecta is much less. You can then synthesize what the X-ray spectra look like, and the way you do this is you use the ejecta abundances and the internal energy of the shocked material to compute what the X-ray spectrum ought to look like from Kepler. So what I'm showing here, the black line is the data, obviously. These dashed lines are the subluminous models, and the solid lines are the luminous models for various mass loss rates. What you can take away immediately from this, come on, here we go, is that the lack of iron emission in the DDT-G models rules them out completely. There's no iron K shell emission at 6,400 EV, and there's no iron L emission showing up. This is all oxygen and neon and the stuff. On the other hand, the DDTA models, they actually produce quite a bit of iron. You see the iron K lines produced here. We don't include a non-thermal continuum, so that's why the shape of the continuum is slightly different at the higher ends. But you actually do see that you get this bump, which is characteristic of all the iron L that you're producing, and you get sort of the right amount of silicon and sulfur. But something doesn't look quite right when you start looking at the line centroids of these individual lines. So you look at, say, the sulfur line here and the iron line, and what you see is when you just focus on the DDTA model, is that the iron and the sulfur are systematically overestimated. Their line centroids are systematically overestimated for the high mass loss rate models relative to what we observe. So in this plot, the hatched regions correspond to the measured line centroids for silicon, sulfur, and iron, and then these solid black lines correspond to what we actually simulate. So this is curious because we clearly think that Kepler is running into some sort of outflow, and we're kind of stuck at that point. So for no other reason than to try things out, we decided to introduce a fiducial cavity around the progenitor. Now, you could argue why you might need a fiducial cavity around a type 1a progenitor. It turns out that other groups have also shown that Tycho's supernova remnant requires a small cavity around it prior to core collapse in order to reproduce both the dynamics and the spectra. And observations of extragalactic 1As sometimes show low-density environments around the progenitors. So we do that. We introduce a fiducial cavity of around a third parsec in size and low density relative to what the wind density was. And I plot those spectra here. And you can see now, and you can't really see it that well, but what you do notice is that the K beta lines of silicon, for instance, now start to become suppressed. But also, you're starting to see more of the iron L that you see in the actual spectrum. And when you do a quantitative study or a quantitative comparison, you actually see now that the silicon K and the sulfur K and the iron K all sort of line up with what you are observing in Kepler. That is to say, if you have a mass loss rate of between 4 and 6 times 10 to the minus 6 solar masses per year, something with a wind velocity of 20 kilometers per second, and a small cavity, so there's a lot of knobs to turn here, and I would be the first to admit that, you can reproduce the line centroids for silicon, sulfur, and iron. And this is kind of nice because this produces a model that both reproduces the dynamics and the, I'm sorry, it reproduces the spectrum, and it also says something important about the dynamics. All right, so the conclusions from this particular study, the main conclusion is that the best fit models that we produce, that we found, tend to imply a 1991 T-like event, that is an energetic supernova. And this was recently confirmed by Satoru Katsuta in a paper in 2015. And Satoru has so many papers that it's worth actually putting the actual reference in whenever you reference one of his papers in a talk. But the downside of this is that if you look at the axes here, our best fit models are right around here. This sort of implies a distance to Kepler that's around 7 or greater kiloparsecs, and this is pretty troubling. Not troubling for me, but it's troubling for a lot of people. Okay, and I say it's not troubling for me because I'm not, you know, I other things to worry about, I guess. I don't know. But it turns out that if you actually plug the numbers in for what a 1991 T-like event is, it's minus 19.8, and I think sometimes it's minus 19.7. So you can, you know, the important thing is it doesn't differ by, you know, order of magnitude, several orders of magnitude. The apparent magnitude of Kepler's supernova, which was around minus 2.5, and then if you look up what the reddening is in the direction of Kepler, for a 91 T-like event, you actually get a distance of around 7 kiloparsecs. So, okay, that seems reasonable. All right, but this is a lot of work, and it's not sustainable. We spent a lot of time doing this one object. Much of the time was spent in fits and starts. So, you know, either we couldn't get the spectra to work, or Carlos couldn't get me to work, or, you know, whatever it was. So there has to be an easier, gentler way to do this. So we can flip the question around. We have this wealth of progenitor models that exist, both for type 1a supernova and for a core collapse supernova. And you can ask the question, does something that looks like this, or you know, a reasonable facsimile of an artist's conception of a massive star cluster, will that give you the observables that you see in something like this? And I keep showing Cassay, but the problem with Cassay is it's an oddball. So maybe I should never show this when I'm trying to talk about the generic qualities of a supernova remnant. So what exactly are the bulk observables that we're talking about? Well, there's spectral qualities. These are include line centroids. So your iron line centroid, such as in this, I'm going to start calling this a Yamaguchi plot. I think that should take because it's been shown about 5 times. And he's not here, so. But he's the one that sort of did this first, as far as I can tell. You look at line ratios, that is to say, like your K-alpha to K-beta line ratios, because that gives you a measure of the density, as you'll see a little later. And then also, say, line luminosities. Dynamical qualities, or quantities, are expansion velocity, which we have for some remnants, and then also the remnant size, which is usually an estimate if it's galactic, but if it's Magellanic Cloud, we have a good idea as to what the size is. And then the environment, that is to say, is it running into molecular cloud? Is it off on its own somewhere? So this has been done for type 1a supernova by Carlos and Arroyo. They had this paper in 2014, and this actually is what really got Carlos and I had been talking about doing this for a while, something like this, but this plot is what sort of got us off of our duffs and got us working on it. They just started out with something simple. This has been summarized already by Carlos, and I'll summarize it quietly faster, or a little bit faster. They plotted the 1As versus and the core collapse on this plot of line luminosity versus line energy for the iron K line. And they found that the line luminosities were uniformly distributed, and the centroids tend to show this clear bifurcation. So Carlos then went off and ran his models for type 1a supernova, and he evolved them out to, say, 5,000 years. And when he then took those models and he overplotted it, he said, lo and behold, I get the right answer. 1a models give me 1a supernova remnants. Okay. We know this sort of already because he did this for Tycho in 0509, and I did it for Kepler, and he recently did it for 3C 397. But what about this side of the plot? We have this whole other class of remnants from Cassay and W49B, which have been talked about extensively, all the way to some lesser-known objects like G0.61 and some other ones. Okay. So let's do the same. Let's play the same game for these core collapse supernova remnants and see if their progenitor models actually inform us about what type of remnant they'll be. So the ingredients are: we need a progenitor and supernova model. And for this particular study, we used, I say here that we used the Kepler code for stellar evolution and also a piston-driven explosion. There's no neutrinos in our model, so that's good. We also ended up using two models for a model for 1993J, so something that gives us a 2B progenitor, and then also a model for 1987A. We evolved these into a standard R to the minus 2 circumstellar environment, and I'm going to come back to this because this is kind of the key point of our talk. And then we take that and we couple it to our cosmic ray hydrodynamics code, which is CR Hydro, which is something that Herman Lee talked extensively about yesterday. And this might be one of the most complete codes for simulating spectra in supernova remnants. It does the broadband thermal and non-thermal emission, and we've also included forbidden line emission and everything else. So this is kind of like the kitchen sink of supernova remnant hydrocodes. And I won't go over it in more detail, but you can look up any number of our papers on this code. All right, so this again is a different version of Arroyo's plot. Now I've sort of plotted it myself. We can simulate the supernova dynamics to ages of remnants for a range of CSM parameters. So first off, what you want to do is you want to make sure you know what you're doing, because that always comes into question. you know, do we actually have faith in our model? So we use Carlos's 1A models, the DDTA and the DDTG model that we used for Kepler, and we evolved these in sort of non-perturbed ambient environments. The 1A environments, as Carlos discussed yesterday, are not heavily modified or highly modified. We use these 1A models as a sanity check, and we also do this, play the same game for core collapse supernova. We use these the 12 solar mass, zero main, age main sequence, and a 25 solar mass, zero age main sequence progenitor, and then these two models as well. We evolve them in these sorts of environments. As I said, we do a sanity check to make sure that we know what we're doing, because it's not obvious. And sure enough, that our 1A models that we calculate give us the 1A properties. The blue hashed mark is the DDTG model, so that's the subluminous one. And the yellow shaded region is, that would be the luminous 1A. So for the core collapse, we actually get sort of the right answer. And I say sort of because there's a couple caveats here. So what these various models are, this red model here is the 1A, I'm sorry, is the 87A model. The green corresponds to the 93J model. And the purple and other purple model, or color, correspond, I guess it's purple and blue, correspond to the two Woosley and Hegger models. But there's definitely some exceptions. And they're pretty prominent exceptions too, right? I mean, CAS-A, W49B, we've been talking about these things for the last couple days. N132D, it's only the most luminous oxygen-rich supernova remnant that we know, or second most after NGC 4449. So let's try to explain these, though. Well, CAS-A, we know that the iron is out ahead of everything else. So the ejecta has not retained any sort of symmetry whatsoever. So one thing you could ask yourself, and this is a question, this is something worth pursuing, is if I take a 93J model and I excise the iron and put it out in front and then shock the whole thing, will that then give me what I observe in CAS-A? And that's something worth pursuing. W49B, similarly, it was an energetic jet-driven explosion. It also is interacting with molecular material. And N132D, and I also included IC443, but you know that's, whoops, come back. That's way down here. N132D is also interacting with a large amount of molecular material, so it's, it's beyond our standard R to the minus 2 environment that we discussed. Okay. So other things that we can track is we can track the evolution of the ejecta emission versus the forward shock emission. And as we find is that early on, we're dominated by emission from the forward shock, not unexpected. It takes a while for all that ejecta, which is quite dense, to ionize up to X-ray emitting temperatures and ionization states. But eventually, you see that the dashed lines here, they tend to overtake the solid lines. The dashed lines are the reverse shock. And the ejecta becomes the brighter of the two components. This is kind of a weird plot and not something I particularly like showing because it's this scaled characteristic age. It has to do with the wind velocity and the ejecta mass and everything else. It's not intuitive. Okay. But here's the caveat. If you take our models, which also give us the dynamics, and you plot them versus the line luminosities, things don't look so promising. In fact, what you find is that for the vast majority of remnants and for all the models, you're underpredicting the line luminosity relative to the supernova remnants' size, and size can be used as a proxy for age. Okay? Well, how do you get around this? Because now you're saying, well, I can, when I'm just looking at the spectral quality characteristics alone, I get a reasonable match. But if I start considering the dynamics, which was the whole point of this talk at the beginning, is that you have to consider these things jointly, how do you get around this problem? Well, it turns out that the blast wave radius is only a weak function of the mass loss rate. But the luminosity, the X-ray luminosity, is actually very strongly dependent upon the mass loss rate. So you can do something like increase the mass loss rate prior to core collapse, and that will result in an increase in the X-ray luminosity without significantly changing the blast wave radius 300 or 400 years later. And we see this in several supernovae where they, you know, just prior to core collapse, they're dumping, you know, a five-tenths or a tenth or more of solar mass into the immediate circumstellar environment right before they blow up, or a few years before they blow up, and 2009 IP comes to question. There's this nice paper in 2012 by Vikram Dworkadas, and there's a poster out there with the same topic where he shows that the environments around core collapse supernova are actually probably quite they depart quite a bit from an R to the minus 2 wind profile. And the reason he says that is because if you have an R to the minus 2 wind profile, you expect the luminosity to drop like 1 over T. But clearly, just looking at all of these light curves of various X-ray supernova, you see that hardly any of them follow this relation. This would suggest, and I don't know if he says this in his paper or not, he may have, it's been a while since I read it, that this shows evidence for departures from steady mass loss. Certainly that's what it maybe might tell me. If you look at it by supernova type, you then again see, of course, that the type 2Ns tend to be the brightest, and they have sort of the weirdest behavior. The 2Ps are down here, and you know, they're kind of their own thing. But the light curves from all of these different types, they argue, and I think that this would go a long way towards supporting the work that we're doing, they argue that we really need to keep following these things in the X-rays for years and decades after they explode in order to probe that circumstellar, that mass loss of the progenitor, you know, at ages of 1,000 to 10,000 to 100,000 years prior to core collapse. All right. Looking at something more recently, we recently did this study on a supernova called 2014C, which started out as a 1B. I think Dan showed some stuff on this. And it started out as a 1B, but then a year later, or whenever it came out from behind the sun, it had transitioned to a 2N. And in particular, when we went back and looked at it with Chandra and New Star, you actually can see the evolution of this iron K line as the blast wave is interacting with this dense shell. You see that the iron K line start to ionize higher and higher, and it's getting brighter and brighter as it does so. And this showed that, at least in this supernova, which may be atypical, there was an ejection of a massive CSM shell maybe about 500 years prior to core collapse. And as I had said previously, other supernovas show evidence for this. 2009 IP ejected some mass 3 years before it finally exploded in 2012, and there's even questions as to whether that explosion in 2012 is terminal. 2010 MC, and then also 2001 EM. These all showed transitionary supernova. I guess maybe that's not the right term, but they transitioned from one type to a strongly interacting type, which suggests that their evolution was not steady. Okay, so we can actually look to the stellar modelers for answers as to how can we solve this problem of the supernova remnants not looking like their progenitors by looking at some of the modeling that they're doing for mass loss in massive stars. So there are two potential sources for mass loss that's not steady in a massive star. The first one is the so-called pulsational-driven superwinds. This is a study that was done by Yoon and Cantiello in 2010, and they looked at massive stars, 20 and 25 solar mass progenitors. And what they found was that you actually, the mass loss prior to core collapse, so look at the scale on this. This is a million years before core collapse. For this particular type of enhanced mass loss, this occurs a million years before the star explodes. And then it sort of settles down again prior to core collapse. And they concluded that this type of mass loss, while it might drive the evolution of the star a million years before it explodes, and it might impact the evolution of how it explodes and when it explodes, it's not going to impact the circumstellar interaction that we're observing and want to observe in the core collapse supernova remnant models. It does actually do some. It does actually enhance the mass loss a million years to 10,000 years prior. You want to find something that occurs years, maybe 10 years or 100 years before the star explodes. So Danny showed some results by Meakin and Arnett from 2010, where they found these convective instabilities in the shells of the progenitors, and Shiode and Quartet Quartier, I can't pronounce his name, I apologize, looked at what this, what sort of mass loss you get from this, this sort of these convective instabilities. And in particular, they looked at the core neon, oxygen, and silicon burning. And what they found is that you can get ejected shells of upwards of a solar mass of material. This is strongly dependent upon the helium core mass. But you can get ejection of shells mainly between, say, 10 to the minus 2 up to 10 to the minus 1 solar masses on timescales of close to 10 years before core collapse. Now, in a massive progenitor, the timescales for the different burning stages of the neon and the oxygen burning goes on for about 1,000 years each. And then the silicon burning, I think, is a day. So you're talking about stuff that's going on during the oxygen core burning phase of this of the evolution. And you can actually get the ejection of this material by convective instabilities before the star explodes. So that might actually solve the problem for a lot of these remnants up here. You can actually, if you dump a lot of mass into this immediate circumstellar environment prior to our models or and the real data, the real stars exploding, you can actually get higher line luminosities without seriously affecting the blast wave radius. And that's actually sort of the next step in the study, and that's something that we've just started undertaking. So with that, I'd like to conclude, and right on time, I think. And I'll just leave my conclusions up, and thank you. And I'd also, before I take questions, I'd like to point out that we are having a Chandra workshop in August for viewpoints on the next decade of Chandra. So if you have strong ideas as to what Chandra should be doing in the next 10 to 15 years, you should come and present them. So, thank you.
I have one, actually two questions combined with each other about the Kepler's cavity, the cavity that you introduce inside the wind bubble in order to reproduce the X-ray spectrum. First of all, which is the density profile of this cavity? Is it a flat or a R-2?
It was flat. So you could make it more complicated and have it a different R-2. So to do it properly, if you were to say have a steady outflow followed by a short, fast wind that sort of clears out that cavity, you would need to do two things. First off, you would need to simulate that wind, and then you would also need to simulate the swept-up shell of AGB wind that faster wind is going to sweep up. So that, but we didn't do that in this case. We just left it as a sort of a constant density cavity.
Yeah, and that comes to my second question, because it's something that I don't understand in these simulations. So reading your paper, you write that you introduce this cavity just to remove this dense region, AGB dense region, and to reduce, in order to reduce the ionization age of the spectra.
Yeah.
However, if you have a cavity, and then after the cavity comes the AGB wind, you have a density jump there.
Right.
So the blast wave, when we hit this density jump, will form a very strong reflected shock, which very fast will shock the ejecta. And in my opinion, this will result in a higher ionization age instead of a lower ionization age. How do you respond to that?
I think that's true, except that the ejecta has now expanded, so the density is lower, so the collisional amount of collisions leading to that higher, it might actually be suppressed because the density of the expanding ejecta is now lower than it was if it just expanded into a pure R-2 wind.
Reno?
So, in my 87 paper on the origin of Kepler supernova remnant, that basically the paper in which for the first time there was proposed, it was proposed the scenario of the bow shock,
yeah.
I was on the basis of the kinematics of the optical shocks, of optical knots, I was proposing to have a given aspect angle of the system. And actually, the same aspect angle has been used also by Borkowski et al. In 92 when they did the simulations. But in your case, I didn't find any kind of orientation. So did you assume that it's just that the direction of the axis just on the plane of the sky?
Yeah, for this 1D, it's 1D simulation, we assumed that it was in the plane of the sky. We didn't assume any inclination of the remnant relative to us. That's right, yeah. So,
Jack.
A number of years ago, I wrote a paper on N132D where I argued that the outer blast wave was the result of sort of a jump in the ambient medium density. And then we later found the molecular cloud associated with N132D, and we sort of felt comfortable it all went together. And so what I realized at that point was that the outer radius then was sort of decoupled from typical set of evolution. And I think you still have it coupled when you plot radius versus the luminosities.
Yeah, whenever there's a strong interaction like that, that's right. So we didn't, well, for M132D and for any of the remnants that show a strong an interaction with sort of a cavity wall or something like that, we're not actually considering that in our plots. But yes, if you took the plot of radius versus luminosity and you considered that at some point, as you say, these two things become decoupled, then that could shift where the shaded region for N132D would end up, and it might actually end up that the data agree with the model. So,
I don't think this is just one object.
Yeah.
N49 definitely also has molecular interaction,
yeah.
N63A, and we heard this morning about a number of galactic remnants that have that interaction.
Right.
So I think that's a very important thing to consider as you refine your modeling of sort of the ejecta properties for the winds from stars that you said, and the further complications as you go further out.
Because, right. So you remember at the bottom of the bulk qualities was the environment, and that's definitely something worth considering, and that includes where it formed.
So Dan, you and I have already talked about this, but as one of the people that's most bothered, I guess, by the large distance, I thought I would just explain a little bit about my concern there. And if the distance is correct, it also has some very interesting ramifications for type 1A remnants. And my argument is simply a geometric argument. If it's 4 kiloparsecs away, its angular size corresponds to smaller diameter, like about 5 parsecs. And if it's at 7 or 8, you're up close to 10 parsecs.
Yeah.
And just from the age of 400 years, it has to have expanded at over 20,000 kilometers per second average velocity since the time of the explosion.
Yep.
That's a pretty high number.
Yeah.
If the distance is correct, it's saying that it has expanded at that. And this is just a geometric argument, right? So it's not... other objects have the same consideration just from first principles. How big can it get in the time that's allowed?
Yeah.
And that's largely my concern. Of course, we derive with a lower distance from the Balmer lines and shock velocity estimate, but of course there's been so much happening in the modeling of Balmer shocks, we need to look back at that and see whether that still holds up, but that was a lower distance as well, of course.
Yeah, it's really puzzling, and I don't know what to say, but we have new Chandra data that you can, one could go, and Steve is the PI on this, he can do the proper motion analysis in the x-rays and tell us how fast it's moving in the x-rays. And the other thing is that there's no Hess detection, but we see synchrotron emission. And that's the fact that you don't see TeV gamma rays from this is a pretty strong constraint on the distance. So I don't want to go down that rabbit hole, but it's important to consider. So.
Yes, one more question, Norbert.
There's a supernova in 1979C who has shown quasi-periodic flux density variations of the last 30 years or something like that, declining but nevertheless quasi-periodic. I saw your slide, and you can actually expect variations of mass outbursts over millions of years, up to 10 to the minus 3, I think I saw there. Is it also possible to see... 30 years translates into 2,000 years before the explosion of the star. Can you also get, let's say, 2, 3, 4, 5 bursts of mass expulsion over that time of 2,000 years?
Well, we see in 2009 IP there were several events prior to it exploding. So I think that you can, I mean, that's over 3 or 4 years. I'm not a stellar evolution modeler, so I can't say whether you can get this sort of outburst over a thousand year baseline, but the plots from Vikram's paper would argue that there's something more complicated going on. That's clear from the X-ray light curves they show they're probing the circumstellar environment much like the radio is, you know, and it tells you that the environment is complicated and not what we frequently assume it to be for remnants. So.
Okay, so thank you again.